Great. Okay, while you're muting yourselves again, let me quickly introduce the support volunteers on this workshop. Again, my name is Nancy. I'm the moderator for the workshop. Our speaker is Kim G. Kim, I know several people have said hello to you already. Our timekeeper is Bobby B. and is our Zoom host on the meeting.
Yes, that's Brenda.
Hi, Brenda. Thank you for your service. Okay. The Zoom host is in charge of recording, muting, and Zoom technical details. We're extremely grateful to all the volunteers who've given their time, effort, and service to make this WOW such a wonderful event so far. It's amazing. A few housekeeping announcements before we begin. Tradition 12 states anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Please make sure to respect our members' privacy by making sure that no one can see or hear other fellows except you. Please keep checking that you are muted, and please switch off your video if you're taking a meal or need a personal break. Our speaker will share for about 30 minutes, followed by questions and open sharing for the remainder of the hour. Please be aware that we will be recording the audio portion of the speaker's qualification today. No faces or video will be recorded, just the speaker's voice. We will not be recording the group questions or shares. So let's begin. Kim, how would you like to be timed today?
I have a timer on my wall, so I'm just going to hit the button and the time.
Okay, great. So the Zoom host may begin voice recording now. Thank you.
It already started, so I go now? I'm good? Okay. So let me just hit my okay button. So hi, everyone. My name is Kim G, and I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from the South Jersey Intergroup, which is right outside of Philadelphia. I've been in OA since 1994. I have been abstinent and recovered since January of 2011. So that's 12 years. But you see, there was a little bit of a 17-year gap before I found my current abstinence. Today, we're going to be talking about step four. I want to let you know that I am a student of the Big Book. So what I'm going to go over is the Big Book directions in step four and five. I'm going to talk about why it was so effective for me to do the Big Book method. Some of that's going to be comparison to other methods that I've tried that didn't work for me. Doesn't mean they don't work, but I'm just going to explain to you why the Big Book method was so effective for me. So if what you're doing is different and it's working for you, I celebrate that. But I just like Emily can come from my own experience. So first of all, step four. I'm going to talk a minute about step three, because what part of my confusion, I think, was I didn't understand step three. Step three said made a decision to turn our life and our will over to a power greater than ourselves. I thought I could do that then. So I did what was called the OA waltz. Steps 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And it was always followed by relapse. And what the Big Book taught me was step three is describing to me what life is like when I'm living by self-will. What I personally found, it was a shit show when I was running it by self-will. So what happens is because I know that, I make a decision to learn a new way of life, a decision to turn my life and my will over to God. I don't have ability to do that. So how do I do that? I do that by learning the skill set of 4 through 9. And then I implement that skill set on a daily basis in 10 and 11. So I don't actually turn my life and my will over until I get to steps 10 and 11. That was a totally different concept to me. Also too, I did a lot of writing and journaling and said it was a step four. And what I learned in the Big Book was that the inventory was not step four. The inventory process was 4 through 9. So if all I did was just write a bunch of journaling stuff, and for me, what that did for me was it reinforced my fear, it reinforced my resentment, it reinforced my anger. And I was wondering why I wasn't getting relief. It was because I never finished the process. I actually never did an inventory if I never went all the way through steps 4 through 9. So we're going to jump in the Big Book, and we're going to look at what we're trying to accomplish in step four. So on page 64 in the Big Book, that first paragraph, It says, therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. Again, the inventory is 4 through 9. This was step 4. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. So what does it mean to go broke as a compulsive overeater? I pick up. So a regular inventory. Now, I hear people argue this. You know, you do the steps once and then you live in 10, 11, and 12. Or you do the steps on a yearly basis, or you do 10 and 11. And then when you have a bigger problem, you go back and you do a third, 4 through 9. I don't care what you call it. The question is, are you doing inventory? So if I go through the steps and I stop working the steps, if I stop doing inventory, what is my consequences? I'm going to go broke, which means I'm going to eat again. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to discover damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. So the reason I like the big book method, it's very straightforward. It's not this emotional excavation of everything that ever happened to me. I mean, I remember doing an inventory once of writing about ages 1 to 5 and then 6 to 10 and 10 to 15 and 16 to 20. What the big book is talking about is that we are blocked from a power. So what I'm looking for is what's blocked me. So if somebody made fun of me in third grade and I haven't thought about it since 4th grade, there's no reason to put it on the list. So that's why it doesn't have to be this big thing. When I heard the word thorough, my old thought was, well, if you wrote a 3-subject notebook worth of a 4th step and I wrote a 5-subject notebook worth of a 4th step, my 4th step is better than yours. No, the idea of thorough is, did I follow the directions as prescribed? Mm-hmm. It's fact-finding, it's fact-facing. It's not supposed to be this emotional, like psychological vomiting of our life. One object is disclosed damage on saleable goods. Again, I used to do a method where I write about my assets. My assets aren't blocking me from a power. So I know I was to work at a department store in high school, and we had different type of inventories. You know, sometimes we just counted I worked in the handbag department. Sometimes we just counted the handbags. Sometimes we tried to find out what are the best selling handbags so we can get more of them. But there was a certain inventory. We looked at what wasn't selling and we put it on sale for 50% and tried to get it out of the floor. Not worth it. That is the type of inventory that the big book is talking about. What is not working for us? What is taking up rent in our head for free that is blocking us to get access to that power? And because I'm blocked from that power, I get restless, irritable, discontent, and I'm going to eat again. So the object is to find those promptly and without regret. I used to sit in a 4th step for like 2 years because I wanted to get it right. And I have to tell you, my one object was to make my sponsor hate these people as much as I did. I wanted to prove I was right about my resentments and my fears and my sex conduct. So I'm trying to do it promptly. Now, this is just for me. This is outside the big book. But when I work with someone and we start the 4th step instructions, we make an appointment for the 5th step. And it's usually within 7 to 10 days. A good friend of mine says, sitting in a 4th step is like sitting in a dirty diaper. We don't want to sit in it for long. Because again, we're learning a skill set. So if we get this, we learn this skill set in that 7 to 10 days, we get out those boulders that are keeping up this rent in our head, we have the rest of our life to live in 10 and 11. So I'm not going to worry about the minor annoyance or something, you know, I'm afraid I'm going to miss something from, you know, I always find like I'll ground on something for 30 years that I'm afraid I'm not going to remember it during my 4th step. If it's on your head, it's on your head. If it's not in your head now, you'll do it in your 10, 11. For me, it's kind of like, you know, going to like an electronics store and they're still selling Betamaxes, right? Like Betamaxes are not good. We have DVDs, we have MP3s. We don't need Betamaxes anymore. That's what we're trying to get rid of. And what the big book does is it breaks it down into basically 3 categories. We're going to look at our resentments. We're going to look at our fears. And we're going to look at our sex conduct. Now, for me, just so you know, it doesn't surprise me a bunch of old white Christian men want to talk about sex as a separate topic. So actually, I do it as prescribed in four through nine. However, when I get into step 10, and if I go back and do any inventory work, I'll use it as relationships in general, because that seems more relevant than just who you have, you know, sexual attraction to. So the resentments is actually a 4-column inventory. The first 3 columns are, who am I mad at? Why am I mad at them? and how did it affect me? Now, there's a line here, because I'm going to do this really condensed since we only have a short period of time. The end of 65, it says, the first thing apparent when we do those first three columns was that the world and its people often were quite wrong, and to conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we continued to stay sore. That, to me, describes why these autobiographical four steps never worked for me, because I never got past why I was angry. You know, if this was enough to write these three columns, I always joke that then that would have meant that the my diaries in third and fourth grade would have made me happy. Because if you pull any diary from when I was a kid, it was, Lori was mean to me. This is what she did to me. And this is how it made me feel. There's our first three columns. That I'm just going to, like, again, I'm going to reinforce my resentments, reinforce my fear. So on 66 to up to 67, they're trying to get us to look at it from an entirely different angle. It talks about if we stay in this, it says it leads to futility and happiness. We squander the hours. It's infinitely grave. It's fatal. To drink is to die. And they're poison. Resentment is the number one offender. So if I stay in these resentments, of course I'm going to eat. How can I not eat if I'm living in all that turmoil? That last full paragraph of 66, this is where it starts to soften my heart. So it says, we turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In this state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had the power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. So I often hear, I have to look for my part. I have to look for my part. That's not the language in the big book. And I don't like that language because it makes it seem like I'm a bad person. I'm not looking for fault. I'm not looking at that. You know, if you have a resentment against and you were abused as a child, there's no part in it for you, right? But what they're asking us to do is look at it from an entirely different angle. So therefore, the best analogy I heard is think of it like a court case. At first, in those first three columns, you're the prosecuting attorney. You're saying, this is the person that's guilty. This is the crime they did against the community. And this is how it affected the community. That's the first three columns. Now we're looking at it from an entirely different angle. We're going to look at it from the point of the defense attorney. And that made sense to me. And this whole idea of the world and its people really dominated us, that's what I saw. If I am going to always be at the mercy of these resentments, then I'm letting people dominate me. I always use this silly example, but I had really bad teeth as a kid. I had braces for 7 years. I was teased mercilessly, got my braces off at the age of 17, went to college, got voted best smile my sophomore year, and I cried because I knew no one could think I have a nice smile. The torture that I felt those 7 years, those kids who teased me when I was 10, had just as much power over me at 20 because I held on to that. I don't want to hold on to that. Someone may have hurt me when I was a teenager. You know, the boyfriend that hurt me, you know, when I was 20, I'm punishing the guy I'm dating when I'm 30. Like, that's not why I don't want to hold on to that. And fancied or real had that power to actually kill. You know, I'll just tell you another silly example. My mom's in a way, so I get to talk to her differently. My mom's always been the kind, Kim, put on some makeup. Why don't you put on some makeup? Why aren't you wearing lipstick, Kim? Come on. Now, what I heard was, because I had cystic acne as a kid, you know, actually into my 20s, and I always wore makeup to cover it up because I felt so ugly. And my skin started to clear up and I got to around 30, I didn't wear makeup as much. So when my mom told me that, my mom was saying, Kim, you're so ugly. You have to cover yourself up. Why aren't you covering yourself up? You're so ugly. Because that's why I put makeup on. And when I finally asked her about it, she's like, no, Kim. She's like, I wasn't allowed to wear makeup as a kid. When I wear makeup, it's saying how good I feel about myself. And I think you're beautiful. And I want you to feel good about yourself and wear makeup the way it makes me feel. So here, fancied or real, I'm thinking my mom's telling me that I'm ugly. She's trying to tell me that I'm pretty. And I had to laugh because my mother has cosmetic tattoos. She has lip liner, eyeliner, and eyebrows and tattoos. That's how important makeup is to her. I mean, I laugh. She lives next door to me now. Her and my dad are basically housebound. That woman puts up makeup every morning. I think it's hysterical. She doesn't see anybody. But so it's not about what it you see what I'm saying? Like it was what it meant to me. And then we have this beautiful prayer. It says, we realize that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, though we did not like their symptoms, which is column two, and the way that they disturbed us, which is column three, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We ask God to show us the same tolerance, patience, and pity that would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When that person offended, we said to ourselves, this is a sick man. How can I be helpful? God save me from being angry. So the way I've personalized this, my youngest brother is learning disabled. He's 50 years old, emotionally around 12. He reads it like a second, third, fourth grade level. And we'll go out to a restaurant and he has a really hard time reading the menu. And I can see the people getting annoyed with him. I think sometimes they think he's drunk because he's got language disabilities. And I can see the moment they realize he's not an asshole. He's just having a hard time with the menu. And they become so wonderful to him and so helpful. And I thought to myself, what if I could treat the world the way I wish the world treated my brother? I'm just going to assume everybody has a disability I can't see. When that person cuts me off in traffic, maybe they just heard their family member was in a car accident and they have to rush to the hospital. You know, maybe when someone's yelling at me in the middle of a store, they just found out their parent was diagnosed with cancer. I have no idea what people are going through. Hurt people hurt people. So suddenly I can find compassion for others. And God save me from being angry is huge. Why? Because if I can be saved from my reaction, from the anger, then people can behave whatever way they want. You can be the biggest asshole in the world and it won't affect me because I can use these prayers to help me find freedom from my anger. So I use this prayer to soften my heart. And then I get to that fourth column, which is what's going to change me. And this is the essence of our step 10. So we're going to disregard the second and third column. We're going to look at that person, that institution, that principle. And we're going to ask, where am I being selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? What do we do in our 10th step? We watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. So we're learning the skill set now of what we're going to do in 10 and 11. So just a couple of things, and I'm going to give you one example. And this is my opinion again. I think God works much more through people's experiences than opinions. So I find it much more helpful if I'm working in a fourth step to ask someone, give me an example of a fourth step. Give me an example of a resentment, example of a fear, rather than can you help me with my fourth step? Can you help me with my fourth column? Because when someone tells me about their resentment about their sister-in-law, it might be the same thing I have going on with my neighbor. So God's going to speak much more, in my opinion, through people's experiences. So selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Selfish and self-seeking, the big book doesn't really differentiate. The way I've internalized it is selfish is I'm a two-year-old kid. I have a toy. No one's going to get it. It's mine. Self-seeking is I'm a two-year-old kid and my friend has a toy and I'm going to do whatever I can to get that toy away from him because I'm going outside myself to get what I need. So selfishness is internal. Self-seeking is going outside. Dishonesty, what's helped me a lot, which is a lot of my 10th step again, is I'm a Catholic school kid. I'm cash register honest because I'm scared to get struck down by God, right? So where dishonesty that helped me were two definitions. One was not seeing the world the way I wish it should be. One of my major resentments at my mom is I wanted her to be Carol Brady. And she was simply Joan Greig. So it's that idea that I'm not looking at the world the way it is. And my dad right now has Parkinson's. I do a lot of dishonesty. I don't want him to have Parkinson's. I don't want to have to take care of my parents that are in their 80s. But my dishonesty is I want to pretend that that's not happening. The other one is not telling the truth when the truth needs to be told. I have this really bad habit of wanting people to read my mind because I don't want to say anything uncomfortable. I had this happen recently with my boss. I have this idea at the end of the year, all these things that need to be done. And we had a meeting and I said, you know what, Cicely, I don't think I'm going to get this, this, and this done by the end of the year. I'm sorry. She's like, I don't care if you don't get it done by the end of the year. I'm not asking you to do that. It was all in my head. But within my dishonesty, I'm thinking she's telling me that when it's really my self-imposed crisis. So just to give you an example, of one of my resentments that was powerful to me. When I went to college, it was in the middle of my freshman year and it was February and I was sitting there doing my homework and my roommate came in and tried to beat the crap out of me. Actually did beat the crap out of me. The guy across the street had to pull her off. They had to call the campus police. She was removed from my room. And I've sent this resentment, Lori beat me up all these years, innocent little Kim. And when I look back at my selfishness, my dishonesty, my resentment, my fear. Now, when I went to college, I had never had to smoke a cigarette, never had a drink, never kissed a boy, and I'm morbidly obese, biggest dork. And I was assigned this roommate, this gorgeous girl, blonde hair, thin, beautiful, all the guys liked her. And I wanted to be her friend, self-seeking, so I can kind of like live that through her. But I didn't really like her. She was really not a nice person. So I'm using her. And she has this official boyfriend, Ed, but she cheats on him all the time. And I'm covering her because I'm her friend. So I'm covering her with all this stuff. And the middle of February in New Jersey, she gets asked by a guy 15 years older than us to go to the Bahamas for Valentine's Day. So she lies to her boyfriend and I cover for her. And then she comes back in February in New Jersey with a tan. And Ed says to me, what the hell's going on? And I told him everything. All the secrecies of a friend, I told him. Why? Again, for me, self-seeking. You know, I kind of had a crush on him. Maybe if I get him to break up with her, he'll ask me out, right? So she comes home from class and her boyfriend breaks up with her and tells her all the things that I did. Her friend betrayed her. So she comes down and beats the crap out of me. Suddenly, I'm looking at it from an entirely different angle. And I want to find this girl, apologize. And I realize what a jerk I am. I would not have seen that if I just wrote the story of how Lori beat me up. That's the beauty of the Big Book Method. So now we're going to get into fear. There's a fear inventory. Now, this is, again, for me, I love it. I find out from doing this inventory, I look at my resentments. What's my resentments covering? My anger. And then I look at my anger, and what's it covering? Fear. So I love how the Big Book unravels this. Everything comes down by fear. It's an evil and corroding thread. I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, I find out in the fourth step, in the step three. So we have a column inventory for that. What am I afraid of? What's the fear? Why do I have the fear? Now, for me, I have a third and fourth column in the one that I use, and it says, were you relying on God or yourself? And the fourth column says, did self-reliance fail you? Kind of a hit that when I'm relying on self, I'm going to be afraid, right? So it's talking here. We have to trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. So the idea is, to me, like, I think everything is finite. You know, if you get a boyfriend, it means there's one less guy out there for me. You know, if you get that job, it's one less job for me, as opposed to infinite, that if my friend gets married, it's showing how much love there more is in the world. If a friend gets promoted, it tells me that there's more opportunities out there. That's where my fear comes in. Everything is finite. I think everything's a pizza pie. And if someone gets a slice, there's less pizza pie for me. And we have a beautiful prayer for this too. It says, we ask God to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. Now, this is for me, that the fifth column in the inventory is, what would God have me be? And often what people will write is, trust and rely on God, which is true, because that's what it says in the book. What I find more helpful, though, let's assume that God removed the fear. What would that look like? So, for example, one of my fears was never getting married. What would God have me be? Enjoy being single while being opened up to being in a relationship. One of my big fears still is getting laughed at. What would God have me be? A worker on workers who's going to make mistakes, and that's okay. So I'm asking that. And just to jump ahead, these prayers, one of the problems I had is I left them in the fourth step. These are the prayers that I can utilize in my 10th step. So as I'm looking still, because being recovered does not mean you don't have resentments, fear, and anger. It means we have a place to go when these things crop up, because I'm still a human being. And I have to tell you, most of my 10 and 11 is fear. That's the thing that paralyzes me. And then we have the sex conduct. So it's not sex. It's not a list of who you've slept with. It's sex conduct. How do I behave in areas with attraction? So I'll tell you one similar ones when it says, whom did I hurt? Some of them was my girlfriends, because see, I was morbidly obese until, and I never went on a date till I was 26 years old. I was scared of men. So I had friends that had boyfriends and husbands, and I would flirt with them, not because I thought something would happen, but specifically because I knew nothing would. And it was so terrifying for me to get male attention. So I had to put them on. I caused them harm. That was really disrespectful. You know, maybe you're at a job and someone has a crush on you and you're not interested, but you use them. That's an appropriate thing to put on there. So we put down, whom did we hurt? Now I'm going to jump ahead again. I think of this as relationships. So we're going to go over the prayers of the relationship prayers. And I do use them as relationships. So we had this sick man's prayer and the resentments. We had the fear prayer and the fears. And in the relationships, we have three prayers. That just shows you how complicated these relationships are, right? So the Joe and Charlie joke is, if you want to know where the sex stuff is, it's on page 69. So on page 69, we have the two of the three prayers. So So the columns are, whom did we hurt? Ask where we're selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate. Then we're asked, did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? And then we're going to do these prayers. So the first one is, we ask God to remove our, to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. So when I first heard that, I'm like, that's easy. He's got to be 6 feet tall, blonde hair, blue eyes, kind of surfer duty-ish. And the person told me, no. Not who you want in a boyfriend. Who do you want to be as a girlfriend? That's your ideal. Totally changed it. So again, when I get to step 10, not who I want my mother to be. Who do I want to be as a daughter? Not who I want my brother to be. Who do I want to be as a sister? Not who I want my boss to be, who do I want to be as an employee? And I've created ideals for all areas of my life. I've created an ideal as a member of OA. I've created an ideal as a member of my home group, as someone who does workshops. So I craft these ideals. The last paragraph on page 69 says, in meditation, we ask God what to do in each specific matter. So first we ask, then we meditate. Why? Because relationships are constantly changing. Again, my parents 3 years ago lived in a half hour away from me before the pandemic. My parents now live next door to me. My dad's got Parkinson's. My mom's in early dementia. I'm now power of attorney for them and my brother who's learning disabled. I handle all their medical stuff. I just finished doing their food shopping before this. The ideal I had 3 years ago is totally different than the ideal I have now. So these, as we change, we ask what to do in each specific matter. Then on page 70, is the last prayer. It says, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity, and for the strength to do the right thing. They're challenging. We earnestly pray. And the last thing we do is we say, okay, now that we said these prayers, what should I have done instead? What I should have done instead is act with the ideal. So as we create those ideals, we look at what we should have done instead. In 10 and 11, we look at our current behavior. We look at what our ideals were and we ask, what could I have done better and what corrective measures should be taken? So again, we're learning this skill set. And I just noticed the time. So we're going to go into step 5. So that's the fourth step. Step 5, one of the lines I love on page 72 is, in an actual practice, a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient. I remember thinking, well, they're telling me I have to share this inventory with myself, God, and another human being. 2 out of 3 is good. No, because I cannot be objective about my own life. Again, my parents just moved. My dad sold the house he's lived in for 56 years. When he told me how much he thought that house was worth, I almost spit up laughing. That house has not been updated since the 70s. There is paneling all over the place. So a third party appraiser had to come in and say, Mr. Greik, you have a 4-bedroom, 2.5-bath house in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and it's in this neighborhood and this school district, and this is how much it's worth. Why? Because she was selling a house and my dad was selling a home. I need some
gentle reminder.
I have 26 minutes. I have 4 minutes, right? I have 26 minutes at this point. Yeah, I have 4 minutes. So once we do this fifth step, my feeling is my job is to reflect back to people the patterns of their lives, ask them what patterns they see. I reflect back what patterns that I see And then that brings us to 6 and 7. So I'm just going to go over the last 3 minutes, the beautiful fifth step promises. And this, again, this is for me. Well, I ask my sponsees to use these promises throughout the week as part of their meditation, see if they're becoming true for them. Call newcomers, share what that fifth step experience is like. I find when we share our experience, it becomes stronger for us. And once again, doesn't mean these are all going to happen at once, but we should be growing into these promises. So it says, we pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once we've taken this step, withholding nothing, we can be delighted. I definitely felt lighter because when I was telling someone something like, yeah, I did that. Nope, I did that too. I didn't feel so alone. Could look the world in the eye. That was my biggest one because I was always trying to determine what you wanted me to be. And I was trying to figure out what lies I told you and how I could impress you with the next thing. I couldn't just sit in my own self. And when I started to feel comfortable being me, I could look someone in the eye. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now I begin to have a spiritual experience. Again, me, Catholic school kid, I thought I could only access God Sunday mornings at 11:15 a.m. in Morristown, New Jersey at Our Lady Good Counsel Church. I'm starting to be able to tap into that power anywhere at any time. And we feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. The broad highway is capitalized. I started to feel a part of Overeaters Anonymous, a part of my family, a part of my community, because those blocks that were coming down between me and God were also coming down between me and the rest of the world. So I hope with this presentation, you get a little bit of an idea of what the Big Book method is, the simplicity of it, but also understand if you don't go forward, then the Big Book warns us if we skip this vital step, we're going to eat again. So the next step is to go 6, 7, 8, 9, and then live in this skill set at 10 and 11 for the rest of our life. And let me tell you, the beauty of that is not that I've been abstinent for 12 years, one day at a time, white knuckling it tomorrow. I'm not going to eat today. I've had 12 years of contented abstinence. And that is available to every single one here. Thanks so much for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Kim, for your wonderful presentation and for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today on 4 and 5. The Zoom host, please end the recording.